Case number 12-5171, Patricia A. Brooks, Appellant v. Susan Sui, Gurneman, Chairman, Merit Systems Protection Agency. Ms. King for the Appellant, Mr. Interante for the Appellate.
May it please the Court, Anne King for Appellant Patricia Brooks, and I'll reserve a couple minutes for rebuttal. Ms. Brooks asked this Court to reverse the District Court's dismissal of her claims. First, a jury could reasonably find that Ms. Brooks' supervisor subjected her to a hostile work environment based on race, sex, and retaliation. And second, the Court did not assess Ms. Brooks' retaliation claims under the Burlington Northern v. White standard, but the record clearly reflects several serious reprisals that a jury could easily conclude would dissuade a reasonable employee from exercising her Title VII rights. I'll begin with the sole issue the District Court reached, the hostile work environment. As I mentioned, a jury could easily conclude that the work environment was subjectively severe or pervasive. Ms. Brooks is a longtime employee of MSPB in the federal government, but when Tommy Huang took over her office in 2005, her work environment immediately deteriorated. Over the next few years, Mr. Huang and his deputy, Nick No, Ms. Brooks' supervisors, subjected her to an onslaught of bullying, humiliation, undue scrutiny, and ostracism that her coworkers were well aware of, punctuated by unjustifiably low performance ratings, an accusation of time fraud, and other serious incidents. The District Court made a few key errors in assessing her claim. For example, the Court suggested that a general rule applied excluding work-related actions by supervisors from hostile work environment claims, but that simply isn't true as a matter of law that such a rule applies. Also, contrary to the totality of the circumstances standard that applies to such claims, the District Court excluded and discounted certain specific incidents as insufficiently serious or isolated. But
Ms.
that's
King,
a question for the jury.
Can I ask you the following question, which is that these cases are, these by nature, fact intensive, and some of the decisions that we've issued in our court and other courts talk about the specific facts of specific cases, and so necessarily we're comparing and contrasting to some extent. And one case that seemed particularly relevant is the Baylock case from this court. Can you explain to us your best case as to why the evidence, the allegations that your client has made differentiate the circumstances of this case from that one?
Your Honor, I can't recall the exact circumstances of that case. One response, however, just as a general matter, is that, as you said, that these are very fact-intensive cases, and therefore looking at the full set of circumstances is important. And Baylock actually indicated that past precedents are particularly in hostile work environment cases less than perfect guides to what should occur in future cases because these claims are so fact intensive. But if you have any particular questions about the facts in that case, I'd be happy to address them.
I guess as an overall matter, it seemed that the course of conduct that was alleged to be the case in that case and found by this court not to be sufficient to satisfy the severity standard seems, I guess, comparable to what you put into issue in this case. Now, they're not on all fours. None of these cases ever will be.
Of course, and I'd also point to a few other decisions by this court that also involved comparable conduct, but where the court thought that the case should return to the district court. For example, Singletary versus District of Columbia involved reassignments of task and workspace. Steele versus Schaefer included interfering with credit for the employee's work. giving an employee a bad incompetent assistant. Baird versus Gottbaum also has facts that are somewhat similar to this case. So I think that given the fact that this court has recognized that, for example, work-related actions can be part of a hostile work environment, that it certainly isn't determinative that there's been a similar case where summary judgment was affirmed.
Could I, at least as I look at the record, the strongest episodes suggesting a hostile work environment seem to be, at least part of the point, the ratings which reduce, the ratings related to teamwork, which seem to have driven the overall rating, which resulted in apparently in the loss of a bonus, and there's a claim of disparate treatment there. So suppose it's the case that you haven't, that your papers don't establish that the differential in rating would qualify as a single act, and this is entirely apart from the question of whether you preserved any kind of claim for distinct acts of discrimination or retaliation. How do we fit the two together? I mean, do we look at the record relating to that and try to run it through the burden shifting analysis that normally applies for distinct acts of discrimination?
I see. So, Your Honor, I believe you're asking whether to assess whether, for example, that act is discriminatory or retaliatory, whether we should consider the burden shifting analysis. I don't think that it would necessarily be run through the burden shifting analysis, but I do think that some of the types of evidence that are relevant to that analysis would apply. For example, here we have a comparator evidence, which is a classic way to show discrimination, and we believe this evidence that Ms. Brooks, who's an African-American woman, was treated differently from her white and Asian male coworkers who hadn't engaged in protected activity does show that the basis for those actions was discriminatory and retaliatory. As for the retaliation claims...
What's the timing relationship between any particular filing, with any EEO filing on her part, and the negative rating?
In 2006, her rating came at the beginning of November 2006, and just a few days prior to that, she had contacted the EEO director about an accusation by her supervisor that she misrepresented her time timesheet, which is a very serious accusation. So that was very close in time. In 2008, she had filed a formal complaint in. I'm sorry, I'm looking at a different action. In 2008, just a few weeks before her November evaluation, her supervisors were interviewed in the course of investigating her formal complaint. And they made affidavits, this was October 2008. Her direct supervisor actually complained directly about her EEO activity in his affidavit. He complained that she had consulted a lawyer, and he said, "I don't expect this to be the last EEO complaint," which we think reflects clear retaliatory animus.
Yeah, I mean, I was puzzled the way you laid stress on that. It seemed to me when you have these workplace conflicts, in the typical case, each side thinks that it is right, right? That's
correct.
What causes lots of conflict.
That's correct.
People think they're right. If a person thinks he or she is right, then it's natural to think that accusations of bad faith or comparable accusations suggest the other side's unreasonableness, which could be characterized in various different ways. So I'm really troubled at the idea that combined of the various sorts, and I think the three of them can be thought to count.
Well, my response to that is it's true that certainly the expression or the having the idea that protected activity is frustrating for a supervisor, that in itself is not illegal. But what is illegal is acting on that feeling. And I think we have evidence of that here.
It's the acting, not the remark.
And if there are no further questions, I'll reserve the remaining time I have for rebuttal, but also happy to answer anything else.
I do have one question, which is to, and there's sort of an argument at the end here about discrete acts retaliation, and I think there's a question as to whether that was preserved, and I...
That's right, Your Honor. MSPB has suggested that it wasn't preserved. We feel the merits are quite clear on that claim and that a jury could easily find that MSPB engaged in actions that would dissuade an employee from protected activity. And the district court didn't reach this question, but the complaint alleges retaliation. Labels are not controlling in Title VII cases. So the fact that she didn't have a separate count for retaliation shouldn't be determinative.
Yeah, but what is the best thing you could point to in her opposition to the motion for summary judgment suggesting that she had in mind any kind of discrete action claim?
Your Honor, that would be Part 5 of her opposition, which is primarily at JA 298-299. And there she argued, made a retaliation argument under the Burlington Northern test. And the district court never applied the Burlington Northern test and never examined whether MSPB's actions met that test. And then finally, I would just add that this is a case where the summary judgment record is capable of supporting her claims on the merits. It's not a case where it would be necessary to gather more facts or revisit discovery. It's all within the cases that exists right now.
Can I ask you this question on this issue of preservation, which is, I know that you have the argument that this was adequately preserved. Insofar as there may be some doubt about whether it was adequately preserved, is there some reason not to plead these types of claims in the alternative?
That's an interesting question, Your Honor. Recently, this court, at the end of 2011, cleared up a question that had been sort of at odds in the district court, whether it was possible to plead these claims in the alternative. Some district court opinions within the District of Columbia had held that discrete acts could not be included in a hostile work environment claim. But then in Baird versus Gottbaum, this court clarified that that is possible, that a plaintiff can plead a hostile work environment and then alternatively plead that or argue that the discrete acts that contribute to the hostile work environment also would comprise a claim on their own.
And as far as I've seen, I think in your answer seems to confirm this, that there were some district court decisions, but there was no binding governing law that precluded the pleading of these.
That's correct, okay. And that's covered. That's mentioned in our opening brief as well.
So Ms. Beard raised it and won on that point.
In Baird versus Gottbaum,
which is the normal thing to do when district courts are not laying out a clear rule.
That's an interesting point. One response to that is the concern that the sort of decision-making of what type of strategy one would need to present before the district court and concern about potentially losing the entire case because it was decided that the alternative pleading wasn't permissible.
I just think the worst that would happen is that one side of the alternative pleading would be stricken. I don't know, were there cases in the district court that said if you plead both, you lose both automatically?
I'm not certain exactly of the outcome of the cases in the district court, whether they indicated that alternative pleading would lead to that type of result where both claims would be lost. But it seems a possible risk under that type of situation.
No question.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. The district court correctly granted summary judgment in this case. Ms. Brooks complains about ordinary tribulations of the workplace that simply were not severe or pervasive enough to constitute a hostile work environment within the meaning of Title VII. Certainly, Ms. Brooks may have had disagreements with her supervisors about criticisms of her work performance and work assignments. However, she alleged nothing more than run-of-the-mill workplace disagreements between an employee and her supervisors. And Baylock, which has been raised today, illustrates why this is not a hostile work environment here.
Am I thinking about the inquiry correctly? Because I thought that at portions in your briefing, at least, you seem to interject into the question of whether the circumstances rise to the requisite level of severity, the question of whether the actions were in fact born of a discriminatory intent. And I take it the way that we're supposed to look at this is we assume that all the actions that are alleged by the plaintiff were born of a discriminatory intent, at least for purposes of this part of the inquiry. And then we ask whether those actions rise to the requisite level of severity.
The district court, that's correct, first addressed whether or not the actions here were severe or pervasive enough under the case law and found that they were not. There's no overtly racial or sexually hostile conduct here, but the court addressed that first part, so the court is correct on that.
It is the case. I mean, it seems to me there are holdings to the effect that, again, let's assume it's either discriminatory or retaliatory. Evaluation producing in withholding of a bonus can qualify as a discriminatory or retaliatory act, an actionable act, standing alone, right?
Correct.
So,
but there are
so
no
the same question I had for plaintiff's counsel. How does one fit this into the matrix of a hostile work environment claim?
Well, first, the Baird case held that a court should not set aside a discrete act in considering a hostile work environment. But the analysis for a hostile work environment remains the same. If there is a discrete act, the court would have to consider whether or not, first of all, that was an isolated episode, which it may well be with a single performance evaluation, and if it's part of a continuous pattern of hostility. And here there isn't sufficient evidence of that. Ms. Brooks is arguing she received a minimally successful in 2006. In their reply brief, the statement is that's solely based on a single incident, which we don't believe the evidence supports, of an outburst between Ms. Brooks and Mr. Huang, H-O-A-N-G, during that period of time. If that's the case, you have a single outburst and you have a performance evaluation. You have two incidents during a one-year period of time. Those are isolated instances. There has to be a pattern of continuous pattern of hostile conduct.
The argument that the other things to make up the pattern would have to be similar in character. I mean, the sort of rule that gets applied in deciding what one can look at behind the statute of limitations.
That's correct. There has to be some similarity and continuity in the behavior, and that's not present in the facts of this case. A single performance evaluation, which is a criticism of if it's negative of an employee's behavior, is sort of the criticisms that are the ordinary tribulations of the workplace, that an employee and a supervisor may disagree. But performance evaluations are part of the ordinary fabric of an employee's work experience, and they may be good, they may be bad. In fact, the evidence here is that Ms. Brooks' evaluations were occasionally good. She had a fully successful 2005 and 2007, and then there were some that were negative. Over this four-year
period.
Would
you say the same thing if it were an evaluation that was prefaced by the following comment? I'm giving you a poor evaluation, and the reason I'm giving you a poor evaluation is because you're female. And then would you say that, well, what that is an evaluation, and an evaluation is part of the general humdrum of the workplace?
Well, in that case, you have evidence that's not present here, where you have specific evidence that it's based on gender.
Right, but this gets back to my initial question, and I think it's something that Judge Williams was asking about, which is there's a first-stage inquiry as to whether the conduct is severe enough to cross the threshold for a hostile work environment claim. And then there's a second-stage question about whether that conduct, in fact, was born of discrimination or retaliation. But I think for the first-stage inquiry, you have to assume it's born of discrimination. And then the question that arises is if you have something that's actionable independently as a discrete act, as part of the course of conduct gives that undergirds a hostile work environment claim, how do you factor that into the mix? Because you know that you can bring a claim based on that action alone.
Correct. This court has not found, it did not in Baird, that a single act would, even if a discrete act, would constitute a hostile work environment in and of itself. In fact, I believe the closest the court's come was in the Ayishi Ito case recently, where that single act had to be so offensive historically, racially, that it might be, and even in that case, there was additional evidence. So to isolate a single event, a performance evaluation or some conduct, it really has to be so severe and hostile that it could stand alone. And that would be a rare case indeed. And in fact, it would have to be something that would be overtly racially or sexually hostile. A performance evaluation is part of the fabric of working. It's an ordinary tribulation. And a disagreement about it does not rise to the level of severe or pervasive. In fact, in Baylock, there was a two-year period where this court found it was too sporadic and episodic. You had four verbal altercations between the employee and the supervisor, two imposition of leave restrictions, two proposals of suspension, and other clashes, much more severe behavior than is present in a four-year period in this case. So a discrete act can be part of a hostile work environment, but a single act has to be so extreme. And a performance evaluation simply does not rise to that level, even if negative.
But it was, I don't know the Ito case. You cite it?
Yes, Your Honor. That was, and I'll give you the cite. Ayishi, AYISSI-ETO, ETOH, versus Fannie Mae, 712 Fed 3rd, 576, decided this year. Part of the holding, this single incident involving the use of a deeply offensive racial epithet by a supervisor might well have been sufficient to establish a hostile work environment, but there was more here. That's the one instance I can think of where a single event might rise to that, and this is hardly a comparable situation than the Ayishi Ito case. So a hostile work environment must be objectively and subjectively offensive, and that simply is not the case here. No reasonable jury could find a hostile work environment on the facts. And even if fact-intensive summary judgment is appropriate, was appropriate, and is commonly granted in cases of this nature, if the court has no further questions, I would submit. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll give you 2 minutes of rebuttal time.
I'll return to the question of Baylock, which counsel for Appelli mentioned. And we do think that that case is distinguishable, although, again, past decisions may not be determinative because hostile work environment claims are very fact-intensive. In that case, the performance reviews were part of the claimed hostile work environment. But one difference here is that there's strong evidence that Ms. Brooks' performance reviews were based on considerations that weren't legitimate. And also, she suffered tangible workplace consequences due to the reviews, such as the loss of bonus and loss of work from home time, and also due to other actions, such as the reorganization. I can address that question of the performance reviews, which counsel for the appellee discussed, and give you examples of why we believe the reviews were based on illegitimate considerations. This is clear in particular examples when you compare her reviews to her white and Asian male coworkers who hadn't engaged in protected activity. For example, her 2008 evaluation was unsatisfactory in teamwork and overall, and it highlights a November 2007 incident where a white male coworker erupted at her during a staff meeting. Now, that white male coworker received an exceeds fully successful that year, and his evaluation doesn't mention the incident. And I'd like to just quickly address counsel for the appellant's point about continuity. I'd point in particular to the affidavits in May 2007 of Ms. Brooks' coworkers supporting that there was an ongoing hostile work environment, ongoing harsh treatment of her during that time.
But it indicates there was harsh treatment of her, but does it expand beyond that? In other words, it might not be necessarily gender or race related. It might just be a conflict between her and the supervisors.
Yes, Your Honor. The affidavits of her coworkers' observations focus on what they observed in terms of her treatment. Our position that the treatment was based on race and sex comes from the comparative evidence, such as what I've just mentioned in terms of how her coworkers were rated in their performance evaluations compared to her. There's also other evidence of race and sex discrimination. There was one other African-American managerial employee in the office who was also a woman, and she was the only GS-13 managerial employee, and her promotion was delayed to GS-14 for several years, supposedly because the supervisors needed to observe her performance, but the record undermines that assessment of her performance. So this is an example of the pattern by the supervisors of viewing African-American female employees as less capable at their jobs, which is certainly also reflected in their treatment of Ms. Brooks.
Okay. Any questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.